Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, this week's other debate between the two candidates vying to become Utah's next governor, the audit that says that Utah did not adequately anticipate or prepare for the onset of the coronavirus, and the benefits for the unemployed that are about to expire while the state pushes to get people back to work during the pandemic. And on the phone for the show today, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers. Thanks for being here, Bethany. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also on the line is reporter Tony Semirad. And Tony, thank you as well for being here. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Hello, everybody.
Hello. And editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle is also on the phone. George, welcome.
Good morning.
Listeners, if you would like to submit your questions and comments about the stories that we are covering today, it is best that you tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We've got a pretty full phone line here. You could also try 801-355-8255 and see if you can be a part of this discussion. I was going to kick things off with the gubernatorial debate, but actually, since we have Tribune editorial page editor George Pyle with us, and George, I just want to briefly touch on a couple of other items. The latest, of course, is the big news that we've been hearing about all morning long. The president says that he and the first lady have tested positive for coronavirus. I know it's not a local story, but of course, it is significant news across the country. What does this news mean for where we are on how we've handled the pandemic, and I suppose what the political repercussions are as well, George? You are the editorial page editor. I'll let you give us some context.
Well, I mean, we're just a month out from the election, and so it's a question of whether we're going to have the two scheduled debates between the president and Joe Biden. I mean, there was already a lot of concern that maybe those debates were a bad idea after the way the last one went. And there were pundits suggesting that they'd be canceled, that Biden refused to participate, that the debate commission installed some kind of system to cut off the microphones of either of the candidates if they keep interrupting, or put them in the quiz show soundproof booth, or hook them up to an electrical shock that the moderators can give them if they won't shut up. So now we are looking at whether the president will be fit to participate. The latest report is that the president now has mild symptoms. They're saying that he was at a fundraiser the other night and appeared lethargic. Whatever that means. The initial report said that when he returned to the White House, walked from the helicopter to the White House, he didn't appear to be ill, according to the reporters who were on the scene. Also, you just have the situation when any president is ill, or maybe you had a heart attack or something else. It can affect stock markets. It can affect the whole world in terms of what people are thinking and worried about, even when there isn't an election,
George,
on the horizon.
You mentioned it, but just because of the amount of time before the next presidential debate, October 15th, that one is almost certain to be canceled. And then the question is whether the one after that will be canceled. And then, in some election years or some races even, I might say, but how will voters make up their mind? I guess, George, this time around, it feels like the idea of the undecided voter seems a little bit absurd. Or maybe I'm mistaken about that. I do want to talk a little bit about that debate itself, because it was unlike any debate I think that anybody has ever watched. And maybe there's two questions there. One is basically, what is the debate for this time around? And then can you account for how ridiculous it became, George Pyle?
Yeah, well, I mean, these debates, to some degree, are out of habit. We've had like three debates between the presidential candidates and one between the vice presidential candidates for the last several cycles. It used to be run by the League of Women Voters. Now it's run by this independent commission on presidential debates. As I say, it's just sort of an institution that nobody would dare suggest should end. It is a way for voters to see the two, or once in a while three, candidates unfiltered. We ask, somebody asks questions, they answer. Voters have a chance to take their measure and make up their own mind. I think you're right that this, probably in a lot of elections at this late date, and in this one even more so, there aren't a great deal of undecided voters out there. So,
right.
The cliche, which has truth in it, is that it comes down to turnout. I mean, even if, you know, 51% of the electorate prefers this candidate and 49% prefers the other candidate, that's not important, as important as how many of them actually go vote. And this year with the pandemic, with questions about mail-in ballots that some people love and some people are really not happy about, then it comes down to a question of, if you think your candidate is a lock, then you might not vote. If you think your candidate has no chance, then you might not vote. That can affect turnout not only in the presidential election, but for all the other races. There are states where there are very close races for seats in the United States Senate, and they also will turn largely on turnout. And turnout, which is normally driven not by the Senate race or the governor's race, but by the presidential race.
Right.
So if people look at this and they either think Donald Trump is ill and his conduct in handling the coronavirus pandemic has come back to bite him, and therefore I won't vote for him, or in some cases, therefore I won't vote at all, then it can make a big difference.
George,
you know, this is,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
No,
I was just going to say, and this is a matter of, you know, you could also say that this is karma, that the White House and the president specifically have been criticized all over the world for how poorly and how much in denial they were about the whole threat, the refusal to wear masks at the end of the night at the debate, which was run in part by the Cleveland Clinic, which is, you know, one of the big medical experts in the world. They kept telling everybody with both parties, Biden and Trump, that they should wear masks. The Biden people did. The Trump people did not. And you could say, although you can't trace particular germ, well, this is what happens when you don't listen to your medical advice.
George, you want to talk about the discourse of the debate itself? And, I mean, cacophonous, difficult to understand at times because of how sort of how much of a, not a brawl, but over-talking, how much of that was happening during the debate. Do you want to just comment on that and what it is about the political discourse now that allows that to happen?
Well, I mean, it was a big mess, and it, in my view, just showed what a thug the President of the United States truly is. He has no arguments. He has no positions that he can make in a circumstance where he isn't just being worshipped by a crowd full of supporters. And all he had was attacks and nastiness, as all he's ever had. Biden is of an advanced age. He's been around for a long time. He does occasionally seem to go up a little bit when he's speaking, stammers a little bit, has a little hard time remembering certain facts and figures that, you know, he has at his command, but sometimes he just can't get it out. Well, that was less obvious, I think, in this debate compared to the fact that the president just wouldn't shut up.
Well, speaking of debates, I'll mention that as listeners may have heard in the news break just before this show started, the vice presidential debate, which is slated for this coming Wednesday here at the University of Utah, the only vice presidential debate of this election. There were some current concerns about whether or not that would go forward, but both the vice president and his wife, the second lady, have tested negative for coronavirus, so possibly no impact there. Though I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
Well, I imagine there's going to be a whole lot more testing. But yeah, if both candidates have tested negative, and so far apparently they have, and they're creating a bubble up right at the university. I mean, they canceled classes for, what was it, 2 weeks to clean out the place. So right now it looks like it might very well go forward,
but you're right.
They probably will be testing people up to the last minute.
Sure. And it does. I mean, a snapshot test doesn't necessarily mean that, a person, you know,
no.
Right. There's still testing to be done. All right. Well, George, we have, I think, covered pretty well, that national picture. And I would like to turn now to the debate, that was more like a debate, that stuck to an actual debate format a bit more faithfully, and that is the debate that took place between the two candidates running for governor of Utah. It was the same night as the presidential debate. And Bethany Rogers, Bethany Rogers Tribune reporter, a central or at least sizable topic of this debate was how the state was handling the pandemic and also the effects on education. I guess, Bethany, tell us how the candidates differentiated themselves on that topic. And you know what? You should tell us who the candidates are, by the way.
Yeah, we're down to the general election candidates. So the Republican nominee is Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, and the Democratic nominee is Chris Peterson, who's a University of Utah law professor. And they met for, as you said, a debate, a primetime TV debate hosted by the Utah Debate Commission the other night. And one of the things that they really focused on this time was public education in schools, and a topic that they covered was how officials are handling coronavirus and what to do about in-person versus virtual classes in the pandemic. And it seemed like there was consensus between the two candidates that it's, you know, preferable to have students learning in-person in classrooms, that there's benefit to that. But kind of the degree to which they found that to be a more pressing and urgent concern kind of was different. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox said that really, in many ways, he believes the disease is less harmful than keeping kids out of the classroom, that, you know, kids are being harmed potentially by the day by not being in you know, experiencing in-person learning. While Chris Peterson seemed to take a little bit of a more, moderated view of that, and he suggested that he would kind of be cautious in reintroducing kids to the classroom, saying that he would start first with the youngest students and, you know, see if everything goes well with that, and then maybe gradually introducing older kids after that. He said that, you know, younger kids, they seem to have most trouble with distance learning and also, you know, have more fewer symptoms generally when infected with COVID. So he said that that would kind of be his approach as sort of a gradual rollout.
You know, I guess, isn't the reopening of schools, Bethany, hasn't that been the cause of some part of the spike in cases that we are seeing in coronavirus? I mean, kids can, of course, pass the illness on to others. It sounds like what you're describing is a difference of opinion on whether or not schools should be open right now. And not that you can answer whether or not they should be open right now, but it's reopening schools is maybe partially responsible for some of the spike that we've been seeing.
Yeah, it seems that a lot of the, especially originally as this new surge began happening, that the numbers were really spiking among young people, especially teens and college-age kids. So it doesn't seem that elementary and middle schools have been as grave a factor here, but really we're seeing the numbers go up among high schoolers and college-age kids. And we've seen a few high schools that have had to grapple with the question of whether to close after reaching the state guideline threshold of 15 infections at one time. And we've seen some school districts decide to close down high schools in that case. Others decide to remain open. So there's a little bit of, you know, some different approaches to handling this surge in cases, but it's definitely been a factor in the current spike. And then, you know, as both candidates agree, you know, younger people seem to have an easier time with the virus. That's not true in all cases, but generally speaking. However, the concern is that, you know, they go out into the community just like everybody else, and from there you can pass on the virus to older people, to teachers, to staff, to parents and family, and the numbers kind of are bearing that out now, where you're seeing you know, the current surge not just contained to this younger population, but starting to sort of spread out into other age groups as well.
You know, there's some more. I guess one part of this debate was Spencer Cox saying that conceivably Salt Lake City school districts should be open right now. I mean, this is the only school district in the state that doesn't have some level of in-person classrooms happening. Salt Lake City School District, in response, kind of hit back at Spencer Cox. How did that happen, Bethany?
Yeah, so the following day, after Spencer Cox made this pretty strong statement, I'll just read it. He noted that the Salt Lake City School District is the only one in the state that hasn't gone back to in-person learning. And he said, and that's a huge mistake. It is damaging our kids, and that needs to change right now. So he kind of came out swinging on that statement. And then the school district sort of responded by saying, hey, the state government has taken this approach that says, you know, local officials, local governments, and local school officials should be the ones imposing restrictions. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. The statement from the interim superintendent, Larry Madden, you know, noted that state leaders have so far declined to issue statewide mask mandates and, you know, against the urging of, you know, major medical groups, and have made that argument that, you know, Utah's a big state and there are a lot of diverse communities with very different situations, and local communities should be able to design their own rules. And they're saying that's what we're doing by starting with virtual learning. We're trying to respond to the needs of our particular community and, you know, expressed that their goal would be to bring kids back into the classroom, but that they're committed to doing that based on guidance from local health officials and local data.
George Pyle, editorial page editor, this is sort of a discussion about what's more harmful, the virus. I mean, obviously to the kids themselves, the virus, especially to the younger kids, seems, from what I understand, having had conversations with Salt Lake Tribune reporter and sort of COVID-19 specialist Andy Larson, you know, they are less likely to have significant health problems, but of course they can spread the virus. And so maybe part of the factor here is Salt Lake City School District saying, we're not opening up schools so that the virus itself doesn't spread, not so that these kids are, you know, are protected. How do you see this?
Well, the Salt Lake City School District made this decision partly on the basis of the fact that Salt Lake City has been the hardest hit by the virus. We were in the more restricted category longer than anybody else. And again, they have to worry. It's not just a matter of if your kid goes to school, will your child get horribly sick? It's a matter of will they pick up a virus and then bring it home to mom, grandma, and everybody else? And they're worried about that. Spencer Cox is part of an administration that's been real big on not issuing statewide rules for cities or schools or anybody else, and saying that except for, I think, a mask mandate for schools, but not making a statewide decision on whether schools should be in person or not. And then the Salt Lake School District makes a considered decision on that very issue, and the lieutenant governor shows up and says they've made a mistake. Personally, I don't think they have made a mistake. I think that was kind of an own goal on the part of the lieutenant governor to presume to tell school districts what they ought to be doing.
Is that politics?
To just ignore the fact that there's more than just the consideration of whether young children get sick. They carry the virus. As anybody who's ever had a child in school knows, with colds and flu that fly through the place like nothing. I mean, even if the child doesn't get a fever and be very ill, someone else might as a result.
George, I was going to ask if that statement by the lieutenant governor might have been political, meaning to score some points during you know, as part of the election cycle, but I guess what I'll say about that is that he has a sizable lead right now in this race in terms of what polling shows, and so that wouldn't be necessary. So maybe not politics. I don't know. George.
Well, it's a political debate, so everything's political. But yeah, I'm not sure why he seemed to feel the need to go out of his way to criticize the Salt Lake City School District, unless he thinks that makes him look good among every other every other town in the state that looks down on Salt Lake City as this weird place that isn't really Utah. I don't know why he felt the need to do that.
Bethany, just before we kind of wrap up the conversation about this debate between the two candidates for governor, I mentioned polling. I mean, polling does show, as I said, a significant lead in the race for governor to the candidate that you would expect. I mean, we do live in a Republican state, a red state, and the Democratic challenger isn't showing as, or it isn't doesn't have the same poll numbers. Can you talk about that? I guess, can you tell us what the polling does show?
Yeah, before the debate, the Utah Debate Commission released a poll in the governor's race that found that the lieutenant governor was far and away in the lead with 55% support among likely voters, with Chris Peterson pretty far behind at about 20% support. And then, you know, there were a couple of other, unaffiliated and write-in candidates with a little bit of support as well. But I mean, they're the main two candidates, and of those two candidates, Spencer Cox is a clear favorite.
Okay, and I want to ask you one more question, and it's a little bit complicated, but these two candidates, they have some nuance when it comes to differences over how education can, should be funded in the state, how education is paid for by the state of Utah. Is there a way to boil that down for us, that difference, Bethany, or is that not, boil downable?
Well, I mean, I think that the long and short is that they both agree that the state should invest more in its students. Utah has been the lowest per pupil funded state in the nation for many years now. Both Peterson and Cox kind of agreed that that was a problem. Chris Peterson, it seemed, is going to look to tax reform, getting rid of the flat tax potentially, or closing loopholes and tax breaks as a way to sort of generate more money potentially for education. While Spencer Cox is really focused on equity as a big part of his plan, and he hasn't released all of the details of whatever, his proposal would be, saying that he doesn't want to get out too far ahead of the legislature, but essentially just saying that kids in rural areas, kids in the west side of Salt Lake, they don't receive the same level of resources that, say kids in Park City might receive, and kind of identifying that as a problem. The only specific he would really give on that is the idea of looking at royalty payments on public lands and trying to maybe, concentrate or rebalance those in a way that favors kids that, are in some of those more disadvantaged areas.
Okay. And Bethany, there's so much more in your story, including a conversation about a ballot initiative. You know what? I'm going to ask you to just quickly touch on that. There's an initiative that will be on the, or not, excuse me, a question that will be on our ballot in November about, that has to do with education funding, kind of cursorily. Can you tell us about that before we head to a break?
Yeah, absolutely. So the state's constitution right now reserves all income tax funds for public and higher education. And this amendment would sort of loosen those restrictions so that money could also be spent on services for children and people with disabilities. Now, Chris Peterson says that he's planning on voting against that amendment because he is concerned that would, those are all very worthy things, but the amendment and loosening income tax restrictions could kind of put education in competition with some of those other priorities, and he doesn't want to see that happen. He says he wants to see everybody get more money. Spencer Cox, for his part, said that that he would just stand behind the commitments that the legislature made to increase investment in education after the passage of this amendment.
George Pyle, quick comments there before we head to a break. It would change the dedicated income stream for education, and perhaps, as Chris Peterson is saying, maybe weaken that. But the idea is to fund specific things. What do you think, George?
Well, I think just as an opinion writer, I think Amendment G is a really bad idea. I think it depends on a promise from the legislature that they, even if they're not held constitutionally to putting all the income tax money into education, they will still fund education. This legislature over the past however many years, has not really shown that much of a commitment to funding education. We're last in per pupil spending, and we would have to have a huge tax increase to come up to 46th. So it's just another way of the legislature playing around and dissing education.
All right, that's George Pyle, editorial page editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. We've also been hearing from Bethany Rogers. And Bethany, thank you for this. We will circle back to you to talk about an audit having to do with the state's coronavirus response a little bit later in the show. For now, though, we are going to head to our first break. And here at KCPW, we are in our pledge drive. And so on the airwaves from where the show originates, you'll hear a request for support for the independent public programming this station provides. Thank you for considering a pledge of support at kcpw.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Back in a couple of minutes.
And you're listening here on Utah Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. UPR programming is supported in part by our members and Silicon Slopes Magazine, focused on Utah tech and startup industries, supporting good causes that affect us all. Information about weekly town hall meetings or advertising in the magazine at siliconslopesmagazine.com, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.
My name is Vonda Jump Norman, and I'm an assistant professor in social work at Utah State University and director of the Trauma Resilience Project at The Family Place. I'm here with tips for how we handle the challenges and opportunities associated with coronavirus. Find the good in what you see. Happiness is approximately 50% genetic, 10% based on your circumstances like income, social status, where you live, your age, and 40% based on intentional activities, what you do to make yourself happy, those actions that you choose to do. When you find yourself pointing out the negative in a situation, stop yourself. Look for what's positive or what could be positive. For example, right now, we're self-quarantining. You might think, oh, my kids are going to drive me crazy. Or you might get stuck in a rabbit hole of negativity about the coronavirus. Things are going to get worse. We know that. And we need to expect it. And things are going to get better. We know that. And we can expect that as well. You can change this moment to an opportunity. I get to spend this time with my kids. I don't usually have this moment. And I'm going to make the most of it.
This tip is brought to you by UPR's Project Resilience. To learn more about the project and explore more resiliency tips, visit upr.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Bethany Rogers and Tony Semerad, and by editorial page editor George Pyle. It is our Friday morning local news roundup, and you can call us to join this conversation. The number is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to at KCPW, and we will keep an eye on our Twitter feed to see what questions you have. Tony Semerad, reporter. Earlier, we were talking a bit about the pandemic's impact on education, but of course, this pandemic has had impacts everywhere, and in no small way on the labor force, on who is working and actually who isn't working, though Utah, in terms of unemployment, is actually doing quite a bit better than much of the country. You know what, Tony, maybe we could start there. Roughly how many Utahns, because of the pandemic, are out of work? Tony, I think we've got you muted. Are you, by any chance?
There we go.
There we go. Here we go. Gotcha. Thank you very much.
And so, you know, we obviously hit a peak in May of maybe about 130,000 people applying for state unemployment benefits. That ongoing claim number is now down below 50,000. Now, it's important to remember those are people that officially have unemployment insurance. The actual jobless number is likely higher by at least 20 or 30,000 on that, and maybe more. You know, the state has done exceptionally well on getting unemployment down with its reopening compared to other states. Our unemployment rate is about half of the national rate right now at about 4.1, which in any other circumstances would look like almost full employment. We've been down as low as 2 and 3 prior to the to the pandemic. But, you know, a number of people have been kept afloat by state benefits and then this incredible infusion of federal largesse under the CARES Act
right.
that have kind of beefed up those weekly checks. And a lot of those deadlines for CARES funding and other kind of assistance made possible during the pandemic are about to expire. They're the end of the year, all of that money, if it's not spent, kind of goes away. And the state is very worried about a significant spike of people that are out of work and suddenly don't have any kind of government support. State benefits traditionally go for about 26 weeks, and if you count back from March, we're getting close to, you know, a lot of people that have been affected by this kind of dropping off.
The
state's worried about that number, and it wants to get it down.
I mean, that's a couple of different things you described there. One is, of course, the falling out of the federal funding that was passed by, you know, a congressional act, and we're waiting to see what Congress might do to try and renew that, though politics, of course, are getting in the way. And then the thing that you just brought up is the fact that there's a maximum amount of time that you can receive the state unemployment. That's expiring. Is there any talk about, I don't know, extending how long unemployment is allowed, or what? I guess here's the question for you, Tony. What is it that the state wants people whose benefits are expiring to do?
Well, that's a good question. Couple of answers there. What it wants them to do right now is not postpone looking for a new job. Something like 70% of the people that have suffered job disruptions in this crisis have told the state all along that they're still attached to a job. Their employer could call them back at any time. And the state's patience, if you will, on that kind of story or explanation ran out in August. It had traditionally let furloughed employees not look for additional jobs and still get benefits. And in kind of the August window, it said, hey, all you furloughed people, you need to start filing 4 job applications a week, just like everybody else, to get, you know, state benefits. So that's been a pretty, you know, significant nudge to kind of get people back in the workplace. And just kind of backing up a little bit, that $600 stipend that was made possible by the CARES Act, which, you know, unemployed Utahns and other Americans got in addition to their state benefits, was a pretty significant bonus, right? It was meant to stimulate the economy and keep people going.
Yeah.
That expired in July, and we've seen a lot of people move off of unemployment rolls since then. Now, it probably has more to do with the reopening than actually losing that benefit. The traditional benefits run out 26 weeks. The state has put additional unemployment benefits in for self-employed workers, independent contractors, so-called gig workers. That'll expire at the end of the year. And then the federal government also extended benefits. So once people ran out of that initial 26 weeks, they had an additional, you know, in some cases 13 weeks that they could tack onto that as part of the federal relief. And that will also end at the end of the year. And in addition, you know, other kind of supplemental assistance programs for Utahns that are hurting, things like boosted food stamps and rental assistance and that sort of stuff, that money will all, you know, essentially kind of evaporate towards the end of the year. So the state's identified hot sectors, hot industries that are hiring that can't fill positions fast enough. Working with industry, it's got a new web portal to kind of connect unemployed Utahns with those jobs. It's off of jobs.utah.gov. There's a little subsection there called Hot Jobs. And then you can plug directly, if you're unemployed and looking for work, you can plug directly into actual listings under those sectors and, you know, see if there's job training or apprenticeships available, that kind of thing.
What about, that's all well and good. I guess what I'm curious about is the fact that, you know, that this is a pandemic. I guess maybe better put, you know, we've got the state's plan is go get a job, and that's on the, you know, economic recovery plan path. But I guess, is it safe to get a job in many industries? I mean, do you know what I mean? We're in the midst of this coronavirus spike in the state of Utah. Are the kinds of jobs available jobs where you might be in close proximity with other people? Or what's out there, I guess, Tony?
You know, there is cold comfort on that front, Roger, with the state's approach, I have to say. There are an estimated 30,000 job openings out there. But when specifically pressed about this issue, the Department of Workforce Services position is, yes, you know, unemployed Utahns who may be elderly, may be immune compromised, or have other health concerns about going into the workplace, they're in the same batch. They have to go out and try to find positions that might accommodate social distancing or let them work from home. And it's really unclear, you know, the preponderance of jobs that are available now are jobs, you know, that, you know, involve some exposure like that. Of course, every job opportunity is going to be different, and applicants need to kind of navigate that through that. But there really is no sort of separate policy for people that are worried about their health and weighing that as they consider going back to the workplace.
I mean, and then I guess, Tony, another question is, what if your employer hasn't reopened? I mean, your normal employer hasn't reopened and isn't planning on reopening because of the fact that they are concerned about what the impacts of the coronavirus could be. I mean, basically, they don't feel it's safe to reopen, and you are someone who is on unemployment assistance, but your company is not allowing you to come back to work. Does that, the state says, go get a different job?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, this $1 million advertising campaign that kind of accompanies this matching program, if you will, for unemployed Utahns and available jobs is specifically trying to change mindsets. It's saying, you know, look, your job may never come back. You need to think about retooling to kind of move people over that hump of like, oh, you know, my job might still be open. I could still go back. The state is quite urgently, honestly, saying, you know, abandon those hopes or, you know, kind of look at your situation and you're, you know, you may have to retool. And they're even saying, you know, hey, you might need to get a temporary job in the meantime until you find your, you know, sort of more ideal position or career. So this is a really kind of steadfast effort to get that number, that 50,000 or so. It's like hovering around 47,000 right now, people that are sort of chronically unemployed, get them back to work.
Speaking of the word chronically, and I'm going to bring George in a minute, but what about for people who have, say, something that may make them more vulnerable to the coronavirus? There are those more vulnerable populations who probably haven't returned to work in no small part because of the fact that should they go back to work and get coronavirus, they are more likely to have adverse consequences, meaning get ill and possibly die. Is there any sort of dispensation there on that front, Tony, when it comes to how the state is thinking about that, people getting back to work?
Well, you know, the Department of Workforce Services does have kind of a review process. If indeed, an applicant or a returning employee doesn't feel like their employer is doing enough in terms of personal protective equipment and that sort of thing. But there's a very small subset of job applicants for whom this process is kicking in. So in answer to your question, there really is not much difference in the state's policy toward people that face additional health concerns returning to the workplace compared to, you know, sort of the more average unemployed state resident.
Okay. George Pyle, this is obviously, again, we're having a conversation that is pitting the idea of economic recovery against people's health and well-being. And this is sort of a repeat of a conversation we were having earlier about schools. But your thoughts on you know, this push to get people back to work and also the fact that a number of benefits will be expiring soon.
Yeah, I think this is particularly tone deaf on the part of the state. I mean, it's just kind of like, you know, get a job, you bum. And it's not that simple. I mean, the Republican idea has always been that if there is anything wrong with your economic situation, it must be your fault because you're lazy or stupid or something like that. This just weighs it in people's face. What you do is to get the economy going again, first you deal with the pandemic and you knock it down as best you can. And one of the things you do is don't urge people to go to work, especially in situations where there's a lot of personal contact and they might spread the virus, especially in circumstances where people are elderly or diabetic or overweight or have other kinds of issues or live with people or care for people who are in that category. We've kind of been in denial about this whole thing, even with all the press conferences and the daily release of a number of new cases. The idea that, you know, the economy and the pandemic are in conflict is as goofy as the Republican idea that the economy and the environment are in conflict. They are not. They are two sides of the same coin. If you want the economy to come back, if you want people to get back to work, you knock down the virus first, and then the economy will come back. And the idea that there will be a lot of jobs out there for people who aren't already trained in, you know, writing software and can work from home is just silly.
You know, I guess the amount of people who have died in the United States is now above 200,000. I think that there are those, though, George, who would say, look, I don't know. It seems like there's an argument that people are making, which is that, oh, the pandemic isn't as bad as you think it is, but it is that bad. I guess I don't know how to, I don't know. There's no question there.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Utah is one of the worst states right now in terms of increasing number of cases, in terms of more cases among younger people who we kind of thought were immune before, which was a stupid thing to think, at least in terms of getting it, if not dying from it. And we haven't had maybe as many deaths because we're younger and healthier and we have a good medical system, a good healthcare system, and we haven't gone through the total nightmare scenario, which is where we had so many patients, we had no hospital beds, we had no ICU beds. We were going to have to open up a MASH unit in the Salt Palace or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it hasn't been that bad.
Right.
And I guess because it hasn't been that bad, I think maybe some people are thinking that we're okay, but we're not okay.
Okay. You know, again, a reminder to listeners that you can tweet to us. Our handle is @KCPW. Just before we head to a break and then turn to, well, our underplayed stories of the week, I want to bring Bethany Rogers back into this conversation for a sort of maybe quick take on some other news that she covered this week. And Bethany, we've been talking about the state's plan to reopen, to try and get people back to work. There was a state audit that came out this week that said that Utah did not adequately anticipate or prepare for the pandemic. And, you know, I guess you think you're not going to have a pandemic until you have one. But where did this audit come from and who conducted it? And I guess why did they conduct it?
So this audit came from the Office of the State Auditor, who's John Dougal. He's been working on it for the last several months, and it's been a highly anticipated review. And it kind of got started after there were some questions about state contracting in the early part of the pandemic. At first, the state pretty much bypassed all of its standard procurement procedures and just kind of went out and bought PPE and signed contracts without any sort of bid process or competitive process between companies. And there were some questions that people had about, you know, how were these contracts awarded and was all this spending above board? So he undertook this review. You know, a lot of people, including some of the candidates for governor, have been, you know, wanting to see this review, has really been eagerly awaiting it and curious about what it would contain. And and it finally came out this week.
Thank you. And part of you mentioned the questions about spending. I mean, one part of that spending was who was sort of the person who signed off on the $800,000 that Utah initially spent. They got a refund, but that they initially spent on this malaria drug, hydroxychloroquine. What did we learn on that front?
Not much. The review basically found that there's very little paper trail behind a lot of the purchases that happened during the early days of the pandemic, and this was one of them where The approvals for the purchase were apparently all verbal. The auditors couldn't really track down any sort of document that explained who signed off on it and why. So that kind of remains an open question. It seemed like there were some mixed messages that the auditors got were, the governor's Office of Management and Budget, which was kind of involved in approving that purchase, said that they thought the Department of Health wanted this medication and was planning on spending CARES Act funding on it. And then the health department officials on their end were saying, no, that was never our plan, and we had no idea that this was happening. At the end of the day, we still don't really know exactly why that happened and how it happened.
Okay. And then some questions about, the audit. People were waiting to see how the public-private initiative called Test Utah would fare in this audit. There were questions about, the accuracy of the tests that they conducted, and also just about the initiative itself. What did the audit have to say about that?
The audit also looked into how all of that transpired. It didn't really look into the testing accuracy itself, but it kind of examined, how did these relationships develop? And it found that, the state steered contracts towards local companies, Utah-based companies that it already had, relationships with, that it already knew. And Test Utah was kind of one of those, a group of Silicon Slopes companies, tech companies based here in Utah, approached the state government in the early days of the pandemic with sort of a plan for widespread testing or their own volunteer effort for testing and potentially even connecting people with hydroxychloroquine, that malaria drug. And that kind of developed, those discussions kind of evolved into the Test Utah initiative. The audit found that, in the early days, the discussion was very much about sort of, an all-volunteer, a philanthropic effort. And even when the state announced its partnership with these tech companies for Test Utah, a Silicon Slopes representative said, yeah, no tech company is going to make any money off of this. Now, at some point, the initiative kind of grew so large that they decided that compensation was necessary, and they did end up signing a multi-million-dollar contract with NAMI Health, and some other tech companies were also involved in this contract.
Okay.
And the audit sort of found that, it's reasonable that, these things are fast-moving, and you can't expect tech companies to just donate all of their time and resources once a project reaches a certain size. But there was some concern that not everybody was kind of aware of these changes, that some high-ranking officials weren't totally in the loop, that this had gone from being, all donated to, a quite large contract.
Right. And there's a great deal more in your article. Auditors could find no evidence to indicate that the state performed any meaningful cost analysis before entering into this contract, a $6.35 million contract for the development of its Healthy Together mobile app. Lots of other stuff in there. But for the moment, Bethany, I'm just going to have to say thank you. And George, I'm going to have to hold off on your offering us a response because we need to head to our final break in the show. Listeners, you are tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back with our underplayed stories of the week in just a minute.
Support for programming comes from USU's Department of History, commemorating historic women's suffrage and investigating access to voting rights in 2020. Events every Thursday through October 22nd at 5 p.m. Register at history.usu.edu. And Aggie Radio, celebrating College Radio Day, Friday, October 2nd, starting at 12 p.m. at the TSA Lounge. Live radio shows hosted by student DJs along with live podcasts. Local artists Guahava, Tree, and Kyle Olson will perform at 6 p.m. Information at radio.usu.edu.
This is a one-minute preview of Episode 9 of Debunked, the only Utah podcast combining evidence-based health practices with storytelling to challenge the stereotypes and debunk the myths about harm reduction, opioids, and substance use disorders. Episode 9 debunks the myth, not my kid.
One way that it's damaging is that idea that if they become addicted, that means they're a bad kid. As a parent, if we believe that myth,
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm on the phone with Salt Lake Tribune reporters Bethany Rogers and Tony Semerad, and also Tribune editorial page editor George Pyle. And we are at the end of the show, and so we'll turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. George Pyle, do you want to kick us off?
Hey, I got a scoop for you. Mike Lee has just tweeted that he has tested positive for coronavirus.
That is a scoop. Thanks, George. Go ahead. Keep going.
And he will remain isolated for the next 10 days. He was at the White House. He met with the new Supreme Court nominee, who had also been at the White House in circumstances where everybody was standing really close together and not wearing masks. So another thing that may be affected by the mismanagement of the coronavirus in Washington is the process of confirming this new Supreme Court justice.
Wow. George Pyle breaking some news on the airwaves here. That's pretty amazing. All right. Well, thank you for that pick for underplayed story. We'll go to Tony Semerad. What have you got for an underplayed story of the week?
Well, it is hard to argue that anything to do with COVID is undercovered. However, there's a really interesting story out of the University of Utah on physician research into the effects on the heart. Kind of relates to some excellent coverage by my colleague Taylor Stevens on the long-term effects and the long-haul kind of effects of COVID-19. Apparently, there is a protein that binds to the heart and blood vessels that creates additional heart problems. Fascinating study.
Okay. And medical research out of the University of Utah, always interesting to follow. And okay. All right. Well, check that out at sltrib.com. Kind of concerning by the sound of it. And then Bethany Rogers, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I also picked a story by Taylor Stevens. This one not about COVID. It's about a ballot initiative in Millard County on hog farms that would basically outlaw some of these new industrial farms if it passes.
All right. That's a good pick. Really interesting choice for underplayed story of the week. And for my part, I'm going to go with a story by a relatively recent addition to the Tribune team, Brian Schott, who writes a story that says that leaders in Utah government are pushing back on there's a sort of initiative or an emergency resolution to terminate Governor Gary Herbert's emergency declaration that's been circulating among Republican lawmakers. And it turns out that some in the leadership at the state government are saying, no, we're not going to do that. Check that out, as well as all of the stories that we have been covering at sltrib.com. Bethany Rogers and Tony Semerad, George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you so much for joining me on Behind the Headlines this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. What a pleasure. And you have been tuned to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. The show is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. And you can find podcasts at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in, and join us again next week.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Joel Kim Booster celebrated the nomination of only the fifth woman to ever serve on the Supreme Court.
Honestly, Peter, I'm just excited that if someone's going to take away my rights, they're an absolute girl boss slay. Yes!
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we do our best to find the upside down here on the underside on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Tune in Saturday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Calling all artists, designers, bird, and native plant lovers. The deadline for the Utah Public Radio and Bridgerland Audubon Society Grow Native for Birds Bookmark Art Contest has been extended. You now have until October 13th to submit your best design celebrating the beauty of Utah's native plants and the many wild birds that rely on them. Your vote will decide the winning design, and it will be printed on an educational bookmark. For more details, go to upr.org, and to submit, just send your design to katie.swain@usu.edu.